Hello, my name's George Horton. I'm the head baseball coach at Cal State Fullerton. I'm here to talk about pitching mechanics. We've got some critical fundamentals, some ideas and concepts that we hope will help you. I've been a baseball coach for 21 years. This is my ninth year at Cal State Fullerton. We've had 9 All-American pitchers in the last 9 years, so I think there's some things in this video that can help you. I'd like to thank Coach's Choice for giving me the opportunity to share these ideas with you. So let's get going. First of all, for you young coaches out there, I think that a lot of young coaches are intimidated by coaching pitchers. They feel like they don't know enough to coach pitchers. Hopefully you'll gain some information from this video, but I'm here to attest to the fact that you don't have to be a pitcher and you don't have to have an extreme thorough knowledge of all the pitching mechanics to be an effective pitching coach. I think we all know more than we give ourselves credit for when working with pitchers. And really the pitching position is a position that is all about repetition. And as long as there are critical fundamentals to the position and as long as you as a coach are getting your young pitchers to repeat their mechanics and do things over and over again, then you can be an effective pitching coach. Here at Cal State Fullerton, we have basically 5 goals that we always keep in mind in working with the pitchers. Whatever we teach in the way of mechanics, we want them to keep these goals in mind. The first and probably most important goal is to establish a rhythm in their pitching mechanics. That can be accomplished in a lot of different ways. And I think one of our principles in teaching and working with young pitchers is to keep in mind that we do not want to coach style out of the youngster. We want them to have their own style. I think if you look into the major leagues and you pick 5 of your favorite pitchers from the major leagues, they all have a distinctive style. So when we work mechanically in drills or work with pitchers in a bullpen environment, we try very hard not to coach their particular style out of them. We do try to work with the critical fundamentals and polish the diamond, so to speak, so that they maintain their style, but they do things fundamentally sound. So the number one goal would be rhythm. The number two goal would be balance. We want to establish balance and have balance throughout the delivery and the follow-through phase. Number three would be leverage. We want to bring things to the table for a pitcher that maximizes the leverage that he can create in his mechanics. Number four is we want consistency. We want him to be able to repeat those mechanics over and over again, which would allow for results at around the plate of a consistent control in the delivery. And the fifth thing would be we want an effective follow-through. Without an effective follow-through, that would create other problems as far as arm injuries and breaking down. I think the second thing is the amount of time that you spend with young pitchers. As a head coach here at Cal State Fullerton, when I do a practice plan, one of my major concern for the benefit of the team is to give the pitchers enough time to develop. If I'm a high school coach or a little league coach, I think a lot of times we look at the total picture instead of thinking about the pitchers and the benefit of the pitchers as a first priority. It takes extra planning sometimes, but we want to make sure that the pitcher's time is the first priority for us. So if there's a bullpen to be thrown that particular day by your top pitchers, we want to make time for that and not get caught up in all the other things that are involved in team baseball and just send the pitcher down on his own to do his bullpen work. So you have to plan for that time, you have to account for that time, and if pitching is 60, 70, or 80% of the defensive part of baseball, then certainly as a coach in your practice plans, you don't want to make that a low priority item. You want to make that a first priority item. So there's a lot of ways to stretch the time that's available in practice plans. Either, again, as I said, in little league or high school, you're restricted as far as time. You need to be more creative and make sure that whoever is the pitching coach in your particular program has quality time with the pitcher and first string catcher with that particular baseball team. And so I guess what I'm saying, the bottom line is make time for the most important position, which is the pitching position. The other thing is you have to have a signature as a pitching coach. If I had any one area that I think has been my signature over the years, it would be control. That is our most important priority for any one of the pitchers that come through our program. And year in and year out, the guys that are most effective and do the most pitching are the guys that have the most control. And that doesn't mean they have to throw 90 miles an hour or 85 miles an hour, but we do work very intensely on having control of their body, which we think in turn gives them control of the baseball and of the strike zone. The fourth thing that I'd like you to keep in mind is to try to keep your teaching simple. The more things that we get on the plate or on the table for young pitchers, the more difficult the skill becomes. One of our major priorities is to try to keep our teaching simple. An example is many pitchers want to throw four or five different type pitches. The more pitches you get in the equation, the more difficult it is to have four or five effective pitches. Typically, with young pitchers, we take the number of pitches away from them. So they may come into our program with four or five pitches, and we convince them to go down to three in a lot of cases. If you look at effective major league pitchers, you can be effective with two pitches, and most of them don't have any more than three pitches, and they're being very effective. And so consequently, we want to keep the number of pitches down so that we can repeat and refine and be effective with those three pitches before we move on to a fourth or fifth pitch. The other thing about keeping things simple in mechanics is the more elaborate a delivery is, the more things that can go wrong. And so we want our deliveries and our teaching within the player's style, again, to be as simple as possible, so that when things tend to go sideways, they have areas that they can go to very easily and correct problems. And the more elaborate a delivery is, the more areas you have to look at to decide where the fix is. So those are very important priorities, and we'll get started into some of the mechanical things. And the next thing I want to talk about is the importance of mechanics. Basically, there's five reasons why mechanics will give us what I said is my signature: control and consistency. The importance of mechanics are in five areas. Number one, they prevent injuries. We have pitchers that throw quite a bit of innings here at Cal State Fullerton, and with improper mechanics, you have a higher percentage of having an injury and a sore arm and his stuff to fall off as the season goes along. The second thing is we want to maximize performance. We want him to be able to throw at his highest level, and without solid mechanics, he won't be able to have that happen. The other thing about performance is with solid mechanics is they'll have longevity within a performance. So after 100 or 120 pitches with solid mechanics, you will not see within a ball game the pitcher's stuff drop off after, let's say, 90 pitches. And so with solid mechanics, they'll be able to maintain the quality of their stuff longer. Also, if they're a relief pitcher, they'll be able to bounce back much more effectively and much sooner, and they will not have the type of soreness that improper mechanics creates for a young pitcher. The third thing that mechanics is important for is for consistency. As I said earlier, for a pitcher to be effective day in and day out, he needs to have that consistency. And with solid mechanics, you'll get the consistency from inning to inning, from hitter to hitter, and from outing to outing. The fourth thing that mechanics and an understanding of mechanics brings to the table is a proper sequences, so that as a pitching coach or a pitcher, I understand the steps involved in a good delivery. And now I will that leads me into the fifth thing, which gives me a system to correct problems. If I don't have an understanding of what my proper mechanics are, when things go sideways within an inning, I don't know where to go first. And we take it sequence by sequence and break the delivery down into different areas so the pitcher, who is the most important guy, has an understanding of what corrections he needs to make to get back in the groove or back in line with what he wants to accomplish as far as control is concerned. So those are the five important areas as far as understanding mechanics. We'll get into those here in a second, and hopefully that'll help you understand what you want to work with your young pitchers in. Okay, we're going to get into the mechanics, and there's basically three phases as we look at it with pitching mechanics. They'll be different from the windup to the set position, but from the windup position, the three different phases are preparation, delivery, and follow-through. Now, of course, in the windup, the preparation phase involves a rocker step, which we'll get into specifically, which starts the rhythm process. That gets the pitcher in his rhythm, and again, there's some critical fundamentals involved in that that we'll discuss, but we do not want to coach the style out of that particular pitcher unless it's creating balance problems. So we allow them, each and every one of them, to have their own particular style and their rocker step to create their own rhythm, which leads us into number two, which would be delivery, delivering the baseball to home plate. And then the third and very critical part of this is the follow-through. From the set position, the preparation phase of the set position involves comfort, getting into a stance that allows the pitcher to have comfort. His rhythm will come once he starts into the delivery phase. So the biggest difference in the two positions, windup and set position, is that in the set position, I don't have a rocker step or an avenue to get into my rhythm before the delivery phase. The second and third phase, whether I'm in the windup or set position, should be identical, and we work very hard to make that happen. So if I took a still photo of a pitcher at a certain point of his delivery, it should look the same in the windup and the set position. So the real difference is in phase number one, in the preparation phase. In the windup, I use a rocker step to create rhythm and to put me in position to get into my delivery. And in the set position, I use a comfortable stance that has fundamentals that allow me to slide into the delivery phase. So really, that's the only two changes from the windup and the set. And again, we want, if I took a still picture of a pitcher at a certain point of delivery, whether he's in the windup or the set, I couldn't tell the difference from a still photo. Okay, let's talk a little bit about foot position on the rubber. As I said in our pitching mechanics, one of our criteria and one of our goals is to have balance. And I want to demonstrate, before I get into the difference in the windup and the set position, I want to talk a little bit about foot position on the rubber and how critical of a fundamental that is for any pitcher, whether he's a youngster or a major leaguer. Okay, the first decision is which side of the rubber to throw off. The typical, most common method would be if I'm a left-handed pitcher, that when my foot drops in, I'm going to be on the left-hand side of the rubber or the arm side of the rubber. If I'm a right-handed pitcher, I would be on the right-handed side of the rubber or the arm side of the rubber. You see more and more guys nowadays that throw from the opposite side of their arm side. You'll see left-handed pitchers use the whole 24 inches of the rubber and go all the way to the glove side of the rubber, and vice versa. You'll see right-handed pitchers come over here and go to the right glove side of the rubber. For me, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I think the theory of left-handed pitcher going to the glove side would be a pitcher that has a sinker or a ball that runs away from his arm side. And the disadvantage to this would be that it takes away the angle and some of the deceptive parts of delivering from the arm side of the rubber over here. Another thing that theory-wise that we believe throwing from the glove side of the rubber is it has a tendency to keep you more in line with your stride and direction to the catcher. It's much easier to stay closed and keep your front side closed with your stride from here than it would be from the more common way of throwing from this side of the rubber. When I stride, if I'm going right to the catcher, I'm going to have a tendency to open up, which creates mechanical problems. So that is less important to me. We experiment a little bit. We allow pitchers to throw from both sides depending on what their stuff is. And we really want them to feel comfortable. I think out of the choices involved, the last choice or thing that I would allow them to do is throw right from the center of the rubber. That way we have no advantage deception-wise or angle-wise one way or the other. What is a critical fundamental with the foot position, and I'll get into this more specifically, is how we drop the foot in. Whether I'm on this side, in the middle, or on this side, the manner in which we drop our foot in is critical. And again, this relates to balance. This will lead into everything else mechanically. If I do not drop my foot in and create a solid foundation, I cannot maintain balance through the delivery. I'm going to have a very difficult time being consistent. So this is the most critical fundamental of all. And the way we teach that is when they drop in, the side of their foot runs parallel to the rubber. Their foot is down in front of the rubber, and that's created a solid foundation, as you can see, for balance. I know some coaches teach to keep one cleat up on the rubber. We don't believe in that because depending on what kind of mound maintenance there is or hole in front of the rubber, you're going to have mounds from ballpark to ballpark that you may have balance problems as a result of that. So when we drop our foot in, the side of our foot is against the rubber. We want the foot to be parallel to the rubber and no extremes one way or the other. And we want that foot to be grounded and create a great foundation to create balance in the delivery. Okay, let's talk about windup mechanics. And basically, we're going to talk about the preparation phase in three different areas: the upper body or the hands and the chest area, the lower body from the belly button to the knees, and then the foot area, which, as we've said before, involves a drop-in step and so forth. First of all, in the hands, in taking the signal, we encourage our players, our pitchers, to get their glove going north and south. This glove is not necessarily a great pitching glove because it's got a web that allows the opposition to look through, but a pitcher should have a big glove with a closed web. We want the glove to be north and south. It's individual as far as whether they want the ball in their hand behind their back or they start with the ball in their glove with their hand down to the side. A critical part of this is that the glove is north and south, not east and west. And when I go in after getting my sign, I want to make sure that I get my entire hand inside my glove, including my wrist, to disallow first base coaches or third base coaches from looking in and seeing adjustments with the ball, which would in turn tip my pitches. We want to hide the ball as long as we can in the preparation phase from the hitter so that I'm not getting the ball down too low in my hand, so where my wrist is exposed and he can see turning it from left to right, or I'm in deeper on certain pitches. I want everything to look the same to the base coaches and to the hitter in the preparation phase. There's basically, from this phase of taking my sign, in the windup, there's three different styles. As far as how do I have a full windup? A full windup would be I go back over my head, straight back over my head. What we call a half windup would be up to the bill of the cap, and then the third type of style would be no windup. Again, we very rarely do we change a pitcher's style unless he's having difficulty getting into proper mechanics. Usually we would change a guy from a real elaborate hand position back over his head to no windup to keep things simple and to eliminate problems in timing and so forth. So I want my glove north and south. I want to make sure that I'm hiding the ball and getting my hand deep into my glove so that the hitter or base coaches can't see. And I want to establish the same rhythm with my hands in the preparation phase of the windup. And the next part of the preparation phase of windup mechanics would be what we call the rocker step. The extremes in the rocker step, first of all, how we went our foot position when we take the stance, we like to have the ball of the foot to be just in front of the rubber. Or if I had cleats on, the three cleats would be in front of the rubber from my dry foot, which in my case is my left foot. I want to be comfortable. I want my knees flexed when I'm taking my sign. I don't want to create tension before I even start my delivery. Then the next phase of that would be the rocker step. Again, the primary reason for a rocker step is to get a pitcher into his rhythm. The extremes in the rocker step would be to step straight sideways, parallel to the rubber, and the other extreme would be to step straight back. What we encourage here at Cal State Fullerton is a direction between the two. We like to teach a 45 degree angle. So it's not a 90 degree angle in either direction. We split the two and the weight goes from the ball of the foot to the heel of my dry foot and back to the heel of my stride foot. My knees are again flexed. I think the most important thing with the rocker step is the distance involved. I don't want to get exaggerated as far as how far away I get from the rubber. Again, all this is creating is rhythm. With a 45 degree angle, when my hands get to the top of whatever they do, if I'm a full windup guy, when my hands get to the top, that is the point that I'm going to drop my foot in and create that solid foundation. Okay, the critical fundamental with the rocker step again is not to get too far away, and what we use as an indication of that is the top of the pitcher's head. We try to instruct them and keep them with the top of their hat over their dry foot. So no matter how far away I step, I want to keep my head over my dry foot. So with a 45 degree angle, again, I'm keeping my head over my dry foot. What that'll allow me to do is get into my balance position without swaying back and forth this way and using my abs to create balance. So with the drop step, I keep my head over my dry foot, and then when I get into my leg lift, my head doesn't have to move back and forth. Again, if a pitcher is shown great athletic ability and he's able to do that and keep balance and be consistent, then we may not change him. Okay, when does the foot drop in? When my hands are at the top point of my delivery. So if I'm a half windup guy, then my foot drops in. Again, to show you the whole thing, I get my sign, my gloves north and south, my hands come together, I'm ready to start the windup phase, 45 degrees, my foot drops in, then I go into the delivery phase or the balance point. Okay, after the rocker step, we talk about leg lift, and I think leg lift accurately describes the method of which they want to get into the balance position. So after the rocker step, when I lift my leg, that is exactly what we want them to do. We have a good foundation here with our drive foot. When we get into the balance position, we don't want to swing our leg this way, which creates balance problems. We want to lift with our thigh muscles. The lower part of the leg is relaxed. The toes are pointed down in a downward fashion, not tense, but down and relaxed. So this is the muscle group that I'm using to get here. and I should, if I have a good foundation, I should be able to stay in this position for a long time without swaying back and forth, which again is a critical fundamental for consistency. So another term that we use is leave the cleats in the ground as you lift, and lift with the thigh muscles. And as you can see, this part of my leg is relaxed and my toes are pointed down. Another thing to keep in mind with the leg lift is we want to bring the knee to the back shoulder. So when I lift with my thigh muscles, I lift so my knee is coming back to my back shoulder, which gets my hips in line and my rear end in line so that I have the leverage that I want through my delivery to maximize the leverage in my throwing motion. So the toes are down, the knee's coming back to the back shoulder. How high they lift the knee is individual. Some guys like to have a very high leg kick and get the knee all the way to the chin. Obviously, I'm not flexible enough to do that. There's not a problem with a lower leg lift. That is an individual thing that each guy will have a different height according to what he feels comfortable doing. Another critical part of the delivery is, as I said, getting into this balanced position. Everything I've done up to this point is centered around keeping balance and getting me into this balanced position in the windup. So the rocker step, the foot drop in, the leg lift is all designed to create rhythm to get me into a good, solid foundation balance position. If I can do that consistently over and over and over again, then I allow myself a much better chance to have consistency in my delivery and consistency in my follow-through, which gives us the number one priority for us, and that's control. Okay, let's talk about the set position mechanics in the preparation phase. Again, this should be the only difference in my mechanics in the windup or the set would be in the preparation phase. First of all, with the hands, we like for our players to start with the ball in their glove, but again, that's individual. Some players like to start with the ball behind their back. The downside of the ball behind the back is, again, it allows the hitter and the base coaches to see, and if I do that, I want to start with the ball behind my back. I want to make sure that I go into my glove the same way on all different types of pitches that I throw, because that can tip pitches if I go into my glove different ways. Obviously, if I throw a split-fingered pitch, that is probably the hardest pitch to disguise and not allow the opponent to pick up the style of pitch that I'm throwing. I want to keep in mind also that the ball's in my glove or behind my back, that I want to keep my glove north and south and not east and west. So I'm getting my sign from this position. The glove is down the center line of my body. It's north and south. Now, whether I take a short stroke or a long stroke or set position kind of rhythm, I want to make sure that my wrist is all the way in my glove, and that when I come set, that I'm somewhere between my chin and my belly button in a comfortable position. Another key point here is to keep the elbows in close to the side so that whether I'm left-handed or right-handed, I don't get in extreme positions with especially my throwing arm or the elbows coming up and down, especially when I re-grip the ball. So I come in here, my elbows are down, and my glove is north and south, somewhere between my chin and my belly button. The foot position as we go down here, whether we talked a little bit earlier about the position on the rubber, I want my foot grounded parallel to the rubber, with my cleats down in front of the rubber, not up here on top of the rubber or with one cleat on top. I want my foot parallel to the rubber. I want my feet about 6 to 8 inches apart. The reason being that I'm comfortable here, and the farther apart that I get or the more exaggerated I get, the farther distance I have to go to get to my balance point. So if I'm 6 to 8 inches apart, from there I can get to my leg lift and my balance point very quickly. If I get farther out here, then if I have a longer distance to go, it's going to take me a longer time to deliver the baseball. I want my toe to be in line with my front foot instep. So what the reason being, now when I go to my leg lift, that it's already closed my front side and I get leverage and direction from that. If I get exaggerated this way, which you see more commonly with right-handed pitchers, where they open up here to allow them to visually see a runner at first, that creates some of the same problems of having my feet too far apart. I have a farther distance to go to get to my leg lift position. So I want toe to instep. If I'm going to open up at all, I want it to be with the upper part of my body and not with my feet. Toe to instep, so again, getting to the leg lift position, I have that front hip closed and directionally going right to the catcher or to my target. As far as the leg lift, again, this is a crucial part of the mechanics. I want whatever height I lift my leg, I want to do it with my thigh muscles. I want to leave my cleats into the ground. I want to bring my knee to the back shoulder in this direction so that if I'm close together, I can get to that point quickly. How high, again, as individual, I think many young pitching coaches put way too much of a priority on the time it takes for me to deliver the ball to the catcher. There's nothing wrong with that, because we want to stop the running game here at Cal State Fullerton also and give our catcher a chance to throw Steelers out. But our priority here will always be our best stuff and control, throwing strikes. By using a slide step or a tuck and go or whatever terminology you use to make this set delivery quicker, sometimes we create more problems. I think we can put too much of a focus and a priority on that, and it takes away from the effectiveness of the pitcher. So we test that with a radar gun. We'll try to get them to have the quickest time that their mechanics allows them to have, but we also want to do that with a radar gun and making sure that they're not sacrificing their stuff, the break on their curveball, or the ability to throw strikes to accomplish that. Again, the feet are 68 inches apart, the knees are bent, I'm in a comfortable position. I think that is a priority with the preparation phase of the set position. I don't want to create tension. I should be able to feel like I can stand here all day and hold runners and take signs or whatever. Then I want to have a quick leg lift so that I, no matter how high I go up, I want to get to that optimum level as quickly as possible and not slowly, which takes longer to get the ball to the catcher. How high as individual? I want to leave the cleats in the dirt, and what we use is a tuck and go. So we bring the knee back quickly, which means I need to get the ball out of the glove quicker, and then it gets into the delivery, which we're going to go into next. All right, let's talk about the delivery from the leg lift position. As we said, from here, whether I'm in the windup or set position, the delivery from this point should be the same. At least that's one of our goals, that we want the delivery from the leg lift position to be the same in the windup or set position. As I said earlier, one of our goals with this phase of the mechanics is to maximize leverage, to get direction, and to be consistent with what I do in the movement of my body, which will allow me control at the other end, which means throwing strikes. From the leg lift position, now the main priority with the hands and the upper body is that I separate down the center line. If I drew a line from my chin down through my belly button, I want my hands to break down that line, down the center line. I don't want to carry my glove back here or open up in front here. I want to separate down the center line of my body. The timing of the hand separation is crucial. I don't want to have my body starting forward before my hands are ready to break. So from the leg lift position, I should be in balance and I can stay over the rubber balanced as long as I feel comfortable. Obviously in the windup, that isn't a problem. In the set position, time becomes more of an issue, but I don't want to rush over the rubber. I don't want to start my body forward before my hands are ready to break, which would cause my arm to rush, to short arm the ball, and I wouldn't have maximum leverage and maximum angle as far as the delivery is concerned. So the two most important things, again, not coaching style out of the pitchers, is to encourage them to break down the center line of the body and to make sure that their hands are ready to separate before they start forward. So I don't want to start forward and then break my hands, again causing my arm to be short and rush and not be able to get on top of the baseball, whether I'm throwing a fastball, curveball, or change, and get the ball going downhill out of my hand. From the leg lift position, let's talk a little bit about the back leg. There's basically two theories or two schools that people talk about. Tall and fall is one term that a lot of pitching coaches use, where the from the leg lift position and the balance position, the back leg is rigid so that I'm maximizing the height of my hips and my release point. And the other technique is what we call drop and drive, where I get a lot of flexion in my back knee here from and before I drive forward. We tend to use the tall and fall, but I think the important part of tall and fall is that we get flexion in the back knee in the leg lift balance position, and that we have leverage before we start forward. So from here, we have flexion so that I can have balance and I can have drive. The knee and the weight should be slightly inside of my front toe. When I start forward in the delivery, the knee does come forward. The back foot pronates here so that now when I land and drive, my foot comes up and over. So it is tall and fall, but we don't eliminate the pushing action and the drive action from the rubber in the delivery phase. Okay, so again, my foot is grounded, I'm in the leg lift position. Why do I want to stay tall? Is because I want the maximum angle, downward angle, that my height allows me to have. If I can get a 15 degree angle as opposed to a 12 degree angle, then I have a much better chance of missing bats or getting ground balls. So by dropping and driving, I tend to shorten that myself and eliminate the angle or the downward angle. So our theory and our thoughts are to stay tall, but to not eliminate the flexion and the drive and the leverage that I get from my backside during the throwing phase of the delivery. In the delivery from the leg lift position, when talking about the hip area, I think the two most important things are that we want to establish a straight line to the target that we're throwing to. We do try to discourage in the leg lift twisting action, which can add to the deception of a delivery, but we think adds to mechanical problems as far as the consistency of the release point. So when we get into the leg lift position, the knee is to the back shoulder. We want a straight line where we're showing the back buttock area to the catcher, and we want a straight line from the back hip through the front hip to the target. The other thing is we want to elevate the hips here, keeping the flexion in the back knee so that we maintain that good downward angle and leverage down the slope of the mound, and not have a lazy drooping front hip to where we don't have maximized leverage down the slope of the mound. So again, eliminate any kind of twisting action, get a straight line from the balance position here, and when I go forward, nothing changes. It's much like a hitter would stride in the batter's box when the hips stay back, they stay in a straight line, and they don't start to turn until my arm's ready to come forward, much like a hitter with his bat and his hands. So I don't want to, when I stride, I don't want to open the hips prematurely. I want to maintain that straight line as long as I possibly can until the arm forces my hips open. Okay, let's stay with the delivery. Let's from the leg lift position, whether I'm in the windup or the set position, let's talk about the stride. I think this is one of the crucial fundamentals that at least we believe that needs to be repeated and worked on and refined, because without a consistent stride point or a manner in which the pitcher strides, we feel like the release point cannot maintain any kind of consistency. So even if a youngster does it a little incorrectly and doesn't do it exactly fundamentally sound, if they do that over and over and over again in the same spot, in the same way, that allows them a chance to be consistent and have control at the other end. So keep that in mind with working with youngsters, that the main priority is that they do it the same, that they land in the same spot every time they throw. In fact, as we diagram up to our pitchers, one of their fundamental goals in consistency is to repeat this part of the mechanics over and over and over again. So now in talking about the stride from the leg lift position, we have our toes down. We don't fight with their style. Many pitchers like for the leg to straighten out and the arc to come down into this position. Many pitching coaches teach to lead with the heel and the hips to keep the lower part of the leg down as they start forward. I don't think that has a lot to do with the effectiveness and the leverage of a pitcher. So regardless of whether they like to straighten it out here as they go, what we want is consistency in the arc and the landing spot to be somewhere within the back foot parallel to the plate. So if I'm to the toe area here, so if I drew a straight line from my toe to the plate area, I would be slightly closed. If I'm right down the middle of my instep, that would be ideal for most young pitchers. Or if I'm to the heel here, I would be slightly open. We feel like anything within the back foot is acceptable. What we try to prevent is, from pitch to pitch, a different landing spot. We would like for the pitcher's foot to hit in the same hole on every style of pitch he throws and every pitch that he delivers to home plate. How the front foot hits, we like it to be slightly closed, which again is easier to keep the knee inside the foot and the weight on the inside toe. It keeps the front hip closed longer, and the weight is here. The front knee is bent but firm. The firmness of the front knee gives a pole vaulting type effect, so I can go up and over a foundation here. I don't want a loose knee on my front legs here where I get too much out here, where I don't have that pole vaulting. Or if you've ever been in a car and had a seat belt on and stopped quickly, that's the concept that a firm front knee creates, that the car stops here and I come up and over, which allows me to create more arm speed on the top side. So again, the most important thing is my foot hits either flat or on the ball of my foot. I'm slightly closed. I have a firm bent front knee here, and my foot hits in the same spot consistently over and over and over again. Now the timing of the weight shift with the stride, as I said earlier, is much like a hitter. When I stride, it doesn't mean my weight is coming forward. I want my weight to stay back as long as possible, like a hitter when he strides, and my weight is going to come forward as my arm comes forward. So the timing of the weight shift is crucial. How far I stride is not a critical issue. There used to be a general rule of thumb that the distance of your stride should be about the distance of your height. We don't fight with that. We don't try to get pitchers to stride out farther. The most important thing is the timing of when the weight transfer happens. And we would like them to stay over the rubber as long as possible, keep their weight back, and their weight comes late which allows them to get out into a good release point position. Okay, let's talk about arm action. After, in the mechanics, after the stride, after the leg lift, we get into a position where we've separated our hands and we're ready to throw the baseball. There are some crucial fundamentals that we try to revise a little bit of our guys' throwing action. We've found that it's very difficult by the time we get an athlete to make drastic changes with arm action and mechanics as far as the throwing motion, because a youngster's been throwing something, a rattle or a rock or a baseball or a ball, ever since he was 2 years old, and we get them when they're 17, 18 years old. It's very difficult to retrain the muscles to retrain that. So when we have to make drastic changes, usually what follows with that is a period of ineffectiveness, and the pitcher needs to retrain himself and retrain his muscle memory to be effective and gain control. Let's talk about the front arm first. And what is important with the front arm is the area from the shoulder to the elbow. We want that to be in a straight line and not get exaggerated either back here, where we have a hyperextension kind of manner, or we get turned here and get the arm too far out in front. We want from the shoulder area to the elbow to be in a straight line. Now, there's all kinds of mechanics and theories about what the area from the elbow to the glove should do. And we don't fight with that. You think some pitchers you see in the big leagues, they have a separation and a mechanic here where the glove is down in this manner, even though they do maintain the shoulder elbow straight line theory. You have some guys that have the theory that they open the hand and glove this way and keep the area from the elbow to the glove out this way. We have the thumbs down separation technique here, which some pitching coaches teach, that keeps the front shoulder closed. I think that's individual. We allow the pitchers to have their own style and maintain what they feel comfortable with. It is important that they use the front arm both in leverage and an aiming device, and to create angles during the throwing action. And so the front arm is important. It's just not important on what manner they get there as far as from the elbow to the glove. We want to create leverage when we break our hands, that from the shoulder to the elbow in both areas is in a straight line to our target. If we have a tendency with our throwing arm to come back behind our body, then we want the opposite straight line angle with our front arm. So in that, with this kind of a arm action, then we would want our pitchers to have the front arm to go in the opposite angle. We can't have one arm going one way and one arm going the other way. So they're opposite angles. And ideally, we'd like that to be in line with our hips and our shoulders and going in a straight line to the catcher. With the throwing arm action, the important part of that is when I take the ball out of my glove, that I bring the ball down here where my fingers are on top of the baseball. So in whatever manner I do that, down the straight line of my body, my fingers are on top of the baseball. I do that down the center line here, whether it's thumbs down or this manner here, I'm on top. A verbal cue that we use for our guys is thumb to the thigh, ball to the sky. So when we come down here, if I can get the feeling that I'm scratching the ball against my thigh area at the bottom, that'll give me the arc, and I come back into this position here with my fingers on top, and many people talk about this as being a cobra position. So I actually want to show the ball to second base. Show the ball to second base. I want to have nice suppleness to my wrist. I don't want to be tense there, and my fingers are on top of the ball before I start forward. Okay? The thumb is back, down, and up. Now, we see many pitchers, Roger Clemens comes to mind, that have a short arc back to that position. This is less important than the position they get in before they start forward. Another important critical fundamental is the elbow is up. It doesn't matter what arm angle I throw from, over the top, high three quarters or sidearm. A crucial fundamental is my elbow is at least as high as my shoulder area. We get into problems when we drop the elbow down here on any pitch and get underneath the ball and do what we call short arm, and we throw with a very low elbow. So I want thumb down to my thigh. Again, it doesn't matter if I cut the arc off and get to this position. That, again, that's individual. But for a young pitcher, we would teach to go all the way to the bottom and up this way, okay? Another important part of the arm action is I want my arm action from glove to throwing position to be exactly the same on all different kinds of pitches that I throw. I don't want to start wrapping my curveball or short on my curveball or my change. I want the same arm action on all my pitches. I want the same arm speed on all my pitches, and I don't want the hitter to recognize a difference in any of those factors before the ball is on the way to the home plate area. So same arm action on all pitches, same arm speed on all pitches. We'll get into grip and different style pitches later, but that is a priority. Now, as far as teaching arm action, it's very difficult for me, and I found it to be very difficult to teach arm action when you put the whole mechanical picture together. Whenever we try to break down or make corrections in arm action, either the front arm or the throwing arm, we usually like to take away the other parts of the mechanics from the pitcher. The two drills that we use for arm action are throwing in on one knee in a very close quarter kind of catch, close distance, so that all the pitcher has to think about are the corrections that you're suggesting to him in arm action. Or we do what we call a no-step drill, where we've already gotten to the stride position here, and now all we work on is the timing and the mechanics of his arm action. So we've been successful with that because we've taken away all other ingredients as far as the mechanics, and he can concentrate on what his arm action's doing. And then obviously the next step would be to put it all together with total mechanics. But you can repeat that over and over again. That's one way you can increase time, because I can do, whether it's a one knee or a no step drill, I can do that every day of the week. I can do that at home in front of a mirror, and I can increase the amount of time that I have to work on that and not just wait until I'm throwing in a game or in a bullpen environment to make corrections that way. Okay, continuing with the throwing phase, an important part of the leverage part of this is the angle that we create with our front arm and our back arm. During the delivery phase, I want to pretend like there's a bar or a straight line through the center of my chest, and whatever my throwing angle is with my back arm, I want the opposite angle with my front arm. A lot of coaches teach to drive that elbow down to the hip to help create a down angle. There's nothing wrong with that, but what that'll do is force the arm up and maybe into an unnatural throwing arm angle. Whatever the youngster's arm angle might be that's natural and most effective, we want the opposite angle, and again, that straight line down through the chest with the front elbow. And we want an active front elbow. We don't want a droopy, what I would call a dead front side. We want this to be an active front elbow. And if you can see the straight line through my chest here, through the point of release and follow through, which we'll get into in a second. If I have a high arm angle, then I'll have a low front arm angle. So it's an opposite angle of what my natural throwing arm angle might be. Okay, so again, that bar through the body. With the chest, keeping in mind that we want to keep our weight back as long as possible During the throwing phase, the term that we use is take your belly button to your knee. We would like to get the chest and the chin out over the front, firm front knee here, so the belly button's to the knee. And what if you can see, what that allows the pitcher to do is shorten the distance to home plate. If he's arched his back and his chest is back here, which means his chin is not over his front knee, he's lost about 12 to 14 inches as far as distance to home plate. And I want the chest out here so that wherever my release point is, I would like that to be as close to the hitter as possible to shorten the reaction time for the hitter. The head should maintain itself in a eyes parallel position. We try to keep during the throwing phase, we've seen Fernando that looks down and all that, but once they start forward, we want their eyes fine centered on their target, whether it be the glove or the catcher's feet or his shin guards or whatever target they're throwing to. We want the eyes parallel to the ground. We want the eyes glued on the target, and we want the pitcher to stay with that target as the ball is released as long as he possibly can. So it becomes target practice, which is what pitching is. If you go to a county fair and try to win a stuffed animal with the milk cartons, that's the theory behind what you're trying to do with your eyes. You're trying to hit the center of the three milk cartons, and you're trying to hit the center of the catcher's glove or whatever your target might be. So the head is in an upright position, the chin is up, the eyes are parallel to the ground. We try to discourage tilting the head or violently throwing the head off the straight line to the catcher. The eyes are parallel, and we try to maintain the height of the head, as we said, stay in tall, and the head should go down the slope of the mound through the throwing phase, so that we don't want pitchers going up and down with their head and eyes as they start forward. So it's a tall fall, my eyes are parallel, and I try to maintain focus on my target all the way until the ball hits the catcher's glove. Okay, with the follow through, after the release of the ball, we want the back heel to come up and over. There's a small circle there. I'll show you that again. We deliver, boom, and we have a violent action going forward where the back heel pronates this way, up and over. It's not as important to me how they finish as it is that they have a complete follow through. I think if we put an emphasis on following through into a solid fielding position, the tendency for a young pitcher will be to not have a complete follow through and worry more about being in a fielding position, which will make him sacrifice stuff and leverage and arm speed, and we don't want them to do that. So the heel comes up and over. We've even done drills where we've put a ball bag or a bucket to help from what I call the leg dragger or the low leg guy. And we want him again to stay up and over the front leg here. And then whatever way he falls through, we'll live with that. If you watch pitchers in the major leagues and watch their fall through, Bob Gibson comes to mind as a guy that had a violent fall through, and actually his back was to the hitter during the fall through phase of his delivery, and he was certainly very, very effective. Another important part of the follow through is that to get the chest to the thigh or the belly button to the knee, as we said earlier here. And so I'm using large muscles to slow my arm down after the release point. You see young pitchers have a tendency to release the ball and stop their arm out here after the ball leaves their fingers. What you're doing there is putting a lot of strain on the backside of the throwing arm, and you develop rotator cuff problems because of trying to decelerate your arm with your rotator cuff muscles. We want to use the large muscles on the backside in your back to slow your arm down and use the whole distance that we have to slow the arm speed down. In fact, in our weight training endeavors, with our pitchers. One of our major goals is to develop the backside muscles and not the front side muscles. Pitchers' front side muscles are already developing when they throw the ball, pitch, throw bullpens, and what they tend not to pay attention to is the backside muscles, which are preventative muscles and they prevent injuries. So we want to use the whole distance from the time of release to follow through to help slow down the arm. Now, where does the arm go during the follow through phase? That depends on what arm angle you're throwing from. If we throw from a high arm angle, then the follow through will be down by the ankle area of your landing foot. If we throw from a 3/4 angle after release, we're going to finish over by the thigh area. If we're a sidearm pitcher, our finish will be over here by the hip area. So there should be an opposite angle in the fall through, just like if you were throwing through a doorway that you walk through. I'm going to go from the top left-hand side of the doorway to the bottom right-hand side of the doorway, and conversely. So we just use an opposite angle technique, and we watch to make sure that the pitcher's arm is following through at the opposite angle where he's delivering the ball from. Another part of the follow through that's important is the back shoulder. We want to show the back shoulder to the hitter, which will do two things. It'll allow him a longer time and to allow the big muscles to slow the arm down, and it'll also keep him, what we would say, stay on the pitch longer, which would allow him to do what we said earlier, is release the ball later and release the ball closer to the hitter. Three pitchers come to mind that I think are very good at that in the major leagues. Greg Maddux obviously is a great example of a late release and showing the back shoulder to the hitter. Rich Aguilera with the Twins does a very good job of that. And maybe the best of all is Mike Mussina. I think he does a fabulous job of rotating late, having a late release, and really exaggerating the follow-through position, and has a lot to do with why all three of those guys are real effective pitchers. As far as all the stuff that we went through, we're going to get into grip and different style of pitches, but as far as mechanics, I want to encourage you to repeat, have the pitchers repeat. You can do a lot of mechanical things without a baseball. They can do this on a daily basis. A lot of the drills, they can be done what we call dry drills, where they go through segments of the mechanics without a baseball. They go through the entire mechanics without a baseball. And really what you're doing is you're expanding the time and the teaching opportunity that you might have with young pitchers. They can do it at home in front of a mirror. They can do it in their living room. But it gives them an avenue to have body awareness and muscle memory, and to take what they've practiced without a baseball and try to imply it with a baseball. If you're a young pitching coach and you're trying to make corrections when they're throwing a baseball, either in a bullpen environment or a game environment, you're going to have little success doing that, because they're thinking about results. And when results get in the way, it's very difficult to make corrections in any kind of mechanics. The other thing that I'd like you to keep in mind, that you should try to fix one thing at a time. If you try to get too many fixes in there for a mechanical problem, I think it's going to be very difficult for the pitcher to understand what you're trying to fix. And we always go on the principle that we fix from the ground up. Starting with the foundation and the lower body, it's going to be very difficult for him to correct anything on the upper part of his body if he still has mechanical flaws in the lower part of his body. So fix one thing at a time, repeat that until he's got that fixed, and then move on to another fix, and I think you'll have better success doing that. We're going to go into the different types of pitches, and the one thing I want you to keep in mind, that fewer is better. And again, we want our guys to have three quality pitches and not five mediocre pitches or four mediocre pitches. And I think the tendency for young pitchers is to go to a pitching coach and say, can you teach me the split finger, the circle change, or the slider? And they want to add to their repertoire, and they really haven't mastered what they already have. And we try to keep that as a priority, not to move on to the next type of pitch until we've mastered number one pitch is the strike. And so I want you to keep that in mind. But on the different types of pitches, I want to talk about the forearm position first. And as we said, with arm action, one of our goals is to have the same arm action on all the different types of pitches. And really, it comes down to two things after that: forearm position and grip. And if we can maintain the same arm action on all the pitches, then we have a chance to be deceptive, which adds to our effectiveness. So the forearm position with a fastball would be where the fingers are on top of the ball, and the forearm is in this position here. Okay, for the slider, we would make a quarter turn here, and we're going to throw the top left-hand side of the ball if I'm left-handed, and the top right-hand side of the ball if I'm right-handed. A curveball, we're going to throw the front of the baseball, and we're going to turn our forearm into a karate chop position. So from the fastball, we have the most violent turn here, and when that happens, is not back here, but it's out here. It's always fastball, 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 then it's curveball, then we turn the arm, and we use a hinge action with the elbow. We don't do a twisting to get the rotation on our curveball. For the change, we pronate our forearm inside the baseball, so we're throwing the top inside part of the baseball. So again, it's forearm fastball, slider. If you can see here, the front part of the forearm, slider, curveball, changeup. Okay, as far as the grips, hand size is going to have a lot to do with it. The grips are always going to be individual. There isn't any one way to throw any of these pitches that makes them more effective as far as movement is concerned. And when we vary our grips, that's really what we're talking about, is making the ball move and spin and getting late movement so the hitter misses the ball on the sweet part of the bat. But grips are going to be individual because everybody's hands are different. But keeping that in mind, the first thing about gripping a baseball is that we want to keep the ball out on the ends of our fingers in most cases, unless we're trying to take away velocity or tighten up spin in some cases. We want the ball out as far out on the ends of the fingers as we can get it without losing control, especially when we're throwing a fastball. And we don't want to squeeze the ball to death. I think a lot of youngsters, especially when they're trying to throw the extra pitch or their best fastball, have a tendency to squeeze the ball too tight, which creates tension all the way down through the forearm. So we want the ball out on the ends of our fingers. There should be a space between the ball and our hand. The thumb is, in throwing a fastball, is directly under the space above that the index and middle finger create. And there's really two types of fastballs. And we talk about fastball grip. There's the four-seam fastball, where we go across the seams here, use the pads of our fingers on a seam for control, and we get the thumb directly underneath here. The space between the fingers will vary from pitcher to pitcher, but the more we spread the fingers out, the more control we have, but the less spin we'll create that way. The closer together, the less control we have, but the more spin we'll get on the ball. A two-seam fastball is the same technique as far as the grip. The most common way is to go between the seams here with our fingers together. Some guys, when the ball's released, you have two seams working for you. Some guys like to get their fingers on the seam here, across the narrow part of the seam, so that when the ball's released, we have two seams working for us. As far as the slider, there's many different variables of how to throw a slider or a cut fastball. The most common way is to take the middle finger, which is the breaking ball finger and put it along this seam with the horseshoe. The fingers are together here, and you put the thumb back here with the ball out on the ends of your fingers against the back side of the horseshoe. So now, again, the middle finger becomes the power finger in all pitches that I throw. The middle finger is going to give me the spin on the slider and the spin on the curveball. And really, when you throw changeups, taking the middle finger off the ball or keeping it from having a violent force on the ball gives you the change of speeds that you're looking for. So again, the slider is here. The ball's still out on the ends of my finger. The curveball, I would get deeper into my hand. I would choke. And again, the fingers are together here so that I throw, when I throw the front part of the ball, as I described earlier, I'm using my middle finger. I've had guys that I've seen throw index finger curveballs, and again, it becomes an individual thing, and I don't think there's any one way. The answer comes from what grip should I use. The answer is whatever gives me the best rotation and the most movement. So I think there's variables on all the grips. The changeup, there's all kinds of changeups. Probably the most popular in this day and age is the circle change. Whether you use a two-seam grip or a four-seam grip, the middle finger is the important finger. If my most common fastball is a four-seam fastball, then I would want to throw a four-seam changeup because I want it to look like a fastball to the hitter out of my hand. If I throw a two-seam fastball most often, then I would want to throw a two-seam changeup. So the rotation of the ball, again, looks the same to the hitter as my fastball, but it's a changeup. Again, the circle change, I use my middle finger to line up the center of the ball. I get my index finger to the side of the ball. I tuck my little finger underneath. The thumb comes up to the side of the ball here on this side. And I'm actually going to throw the top inside part of the baseball. This is a pitch that if it's learned effectively, gets a lot off the miles per hour, 10 to 12 miles per hour, and it has good late movement, downward action, and really is the most effective changeup if a pitcher can master the feel and the command of this pitch. We've had a lot of success with what we call a three-finger change, where as you can see, you put the ball deeper into your palm and you do what we call choke the ball, but you still throw the top inside part of the ball and pronate inside here on the release, and the ball, as you can see, the middle finger comes off the ball and gives you that inside rotation to make the ball sink. So there's all kinds of methods to throw the changeup. The split is a real popular pitch in this day and age, and basically the split or the fork ball, as they called it back when I played. To me, the difference is I try to get my fingers off the seam. I have small hands, so I have a difficult time splitting the baseball. Guys with longer fingers have an easier time with this. But as you can see, the inside part of my fingers are on the smooth part of the ball. The thumb is directly underneath here, and that would be a split-fingered fastball. If I put the ball deeper into my middle and index finger and put the thumb on the side, then that would be what I would call a fork ball. So now it's a slower pitch than the split-fingered fastball. It has less rotation, and it has more of a tumbling effect like a knuckleball would than a split-fingered fastball would have. I think if this pitch is thrown correctly, there isn't any danger of hurting the elbow, which some theories out there now worry about of a young pitcher throwing a split-fingered fastball or a fork. It has more to do with the mechanics than it does of this particular style of pitch. It can be a very effective pitch because of the late movement that you get to the hitter. It looks like a fastball. It has fastball arm speed, and then it dips late in the strike zone, and the hitters have a tendency to
either swing over the ball or hit ground balls. So those are the different styles of pitches, and those are the different styles of grips. Again, I don't fight with pitchers and tell them they have to throw or grip the ball my way. We experiment a little bit, see what works, and again, the answer to what type of grip they should use comes from the spin on the ball and the type of movement that we get on any one of these five different types of pitches. I'd like to thank Coach's Choice for allowing me to do this instructional video. We've had a lot of success with the fundamentals and ideas that I've shared with you, and I hope you have the same.